Tradition, the Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought, published by the Rabbinical Council of America, is proud to present A Jewish Philosophy of Man, a lecture series by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. The Rav delivered this series of 12 lectures in 1958 and 1959 before an audience of Jewish social service professionals as part of a program of the Jewish Education Committee of New York. Using audio files provided by the Toras HaRav Foundation, these recordings have been curated and remastered by Mark Smilowitz in order to provide the best listening and learning experience. For more information, including full transcriptions and supplementary materials for this series, please visit the Tradition website at traditiononline.org/JPM. Lecture 6, Judaism's Glorification of the Anonymous Person, originally delivered on February 5th, 1959.
Of course, it's a continuation of the lecture you delivered me 3 weeks ago, I believe, yes?
Yes.
You'll excuse me that I couldn't be here last Thursday that I could be in Washington. And this is a continuation of the lecture. If you will just try to pick up the thread, and that we discuss the problem of the, what do you call, numinous man, man for himself, man without accomplishments for society, man who hasn't contributed anything to the further advancement of mankind, but the worth of man is in himself. Well, that's what we discussed, and how Judaism in many forms, I mean, in halakhic level, has emphasized time and again the worth of the person without accomplishment. And I said that Judaism reached paradoxically, and we would say has formulated a paradoxical ideal. It means the apotheosis of anonymity, the anonymous person. And if one is anonymous, apparently, he didn't distinguish himself, but because he's anonymous, so there is inner worth to him. This is the Judaic approach, perhaps an impractical approach. And that time, I give you the example how the community must not sacrifice individual, even if the individual, I mean, is ethically, morally, I mean, actually a corrupt and say, personality. And also about the case, the clear case of the high priest finding an abandoned corpse on the day preceding Yom Kippur, how he must defile himself and bury the corpse, although by so doing he'll disqualify himself from officiating at the service. It means the most solemn service of the year is being overridden by the need of the part of King God to understand the tragedy and also the worth of the abandoned, lonely person. Now I'll continue with a few more examples, because I'm very typical, it's a very tender attitude, but it's very typical of Judaism. Interesting also is the maxim in the Talmud. Agre de kala duchto. Kala used to be the famous assemblies in Talmudic times, to which scholars from all parts of, say, of Babylonia and Palestine used to get together, to assemble, and it was academic, actually, I mean, academic conferences, and all kinds of topics were discussed and analyzed. I mean, people delivered lectures and so forth. Basically, Talmud, the Talmudic literature, is a result of such assemblies, of those assemblies. So the Talmud says that the participants in the Kala assembly, they're called Kala, the participants in the Kala assemblies. Probably it's due to the fact that there were universal assemblies, like the Catholics call now ecumenical, I mean, universal assemblies. I mean, they discussed a variety of subjects in those assemblies. I mean, and actually, those assemblies were the most, you may say they were legislative in character. I mean, they used to lay down the law, formulate, interpret the law. And actually, I mean, Judaism, halakhic Judaism, is a result of those assemblies. So the participants in the Kala assemblies will be rewarded in accordance, rewarded by God. And let's not forget that Talmud Torah, I mean, the study of the law, study of the Torah, is considered by Judaism one of the most significant deeds on the part of man. So it will be rewarded not in accordance with their intellectual achievements, but with the amount of discomfort they underwent during the sessions. So, for instance, two people, for instance, it's very strange, two people participated in a Torah symposium. One was bright and scholastically well-trained, and hence enjoyed the discussion, the brilliance of the debaters, and the ingenuity of the intellectual combat at the symposium. The other one, with a very limited capacity, bordering almost on the dull, did not grasp the fine points of discussion. He could not follow the reasoning of the opponent. He was bored and lonely. He felt that he did not belong to that circle of great intellect. I mean, if I should come into a society of theoretical physicists, I mean, how feel like that? So, that he was an outsider who could never be integrated into the world of thought. And yet, he diligently attended all sessions, listened carefully to each word. Out of them, he could not tear himself away from the academy. Why, I mean, men act sometimes irrationally. If he didn't understand, so didn't he leave? So I ask also, why do you sit here and listen to me? Because I don't say anything new. Basically, what I say is commonplace in Judaism. It's a truth. And I believe you know as much as I do about it. Perhaps I formulate it a little different. But people are irrational. Many times I attend, and many times I can't understand why people come to listen to my speeches and lectures. So there's nothing new in me. I mean, I'm not a sense of false modesty. I mean, what I say is something which everybody feels. I try to spell it out. But somehow people act in irrational manner sometimes. He could not tear himself away from the academy. He was very uncomfortable, depressed and angered by the fact, of course, in that case, that he somehow was outside of the debate, outside of that circle. And he wasted his time. The psychological reason why he did it is irrelevant. And simply, I mean, immaterial. The fact that he felt uncomfortable because of certain either drawbacks or because the people bored him, he knew more than they. God will measure the reward not by the standards of accomplishment, but by those of pain and suffering, the individual experiences. It means agre de kalo duchke, means reward for a scholastic session. Depends how hard the bench was, the bench on which the person was sitting. Duchke means pressure. Yehadus insisted upon full axiological democracy. You see, this is a kind of democracy which modern man doesn't understand. Modern man understands political democracy, as I said once, understands also perhaps economic democracy, as the, so to say, socialist countries claim to understand. It isn't true, perhaps, but he doesn't understand democracy axiological as to the worth of the person. That the great scholar, the scientist, and the little person have the same worth that modern man didn't understand, and I don't believe I understand, and perhaps no one understands. But Judaism insisted upon it. Judaism was both realistic at times, and at times it was daydreaming, simply. Completely caught in the web of fantasy and imagination. But it was a beautiful fantasy, at least. I mean, fortunately, I'll tell you frankly, for instance, now with the emergence of the State of Israel, I utter one prayer, and simply my mind many times is disturbed. We have a beautiful attic. And to say that we were angels, hard to say, but more or less, the pages of our history are not stained with blood and tears and injustice and brutality, as the pages of history, I mean, of the European society, let us take the feudal times, the medieval times. Simple reason, not because perhaps we were superior to them, we simply did not encounter the challenge. We never had a state, we never had political problems. Each one lived for himself. A private person cannot commit, a private person, a weak person, a persecuted person, a person who did not have anything to say, could not commit the injustices of which, for instance, France or Germany or feudal England committed, I mean, in the Middle Ages, of course. But what, I many times ask, what if our history had been different, had taken a different course? What if we had been a state, I mean, in the Middle Ages? How would we have acted? Just like the feudal lords, or we would have acted differently because of Judaic ethics? I have no answer to that. Who knows? I mean, to say hypothetically why, how we would have acted is ridiculous. Now with the state of Israel, I mean, the test is come. We are facing the test. Will we behave like any other state ethically? And basically, any state is not ethical. I don't believe that a state that itself implies an intrinsic contradiction to ethics. The best one. Will we act differently? Will we, I mean, restrain ourselves from engaging in certain practices which are in conflict with the basic Judaic ethics, or will yield temptation? Of course, a few experiences are not very assuring, I must tell you. Others somehow hold out, I mean, so to say, a hope. I don't know. But this is, to me, this is the basic problem with which we diaspora Jews are faced with regard to the state of Israel. We are not helping. Helping is a different story. I'll come to the problem yet. But the problem is, here we have an opportunity. The Jews are the rulers. They legislate the laws. They are, so to say, the masters. We have never been masters in our history. We've always been the subordinates, always. Since the destruction of the Second Temple, it's 1900 years ago, I mean, it's quite a time. It's a long time. Now we are the masters, of course, in a small land, in a narrow strip along the Eastern Mediterranean. Will we act like masters? Or will we understand it that Judaism does not know the concept of master and slave, victor and vanquished, powerful and weak? I mean, this is my problem with regard to the state of Israel. I mean, the whole Jewish history will be interpreted in terms of what the state of Israel will do in the next 50 years. The state of Israel will not live up to the great hopes and challenges, I mean, of Judaic ethics. I'm not speaking now about economics and science. I mean, this is a secondary problem to me. Then the whole Jewish history will appear in a different light. People will reinterpret Jewish history. So the Jews were not decent because so they didn't have the opportunity to be wicked. But as soon as they got the opportunity, I mean, they proved to the world that they're not better than anybody else.
Are you talking about being wicked as a state, as a government, or as individuals?
It's both. It's reflective.
Well, why didn't Jews have an opportunity to be wicked in the past?
Well, wickedness always is an expression, is interdependent with simply with power. If a man has no power, he cannot be wicked.
But he didn't have power in the state, but in his individual life and in his group, he had that power.
Yes, but don't forget that the Jews, even as a group, had power, but the group itself was persecuted. You understand? The powerful group within the Jewish community was persecuted by the outside community. So the person who was about to persecute the weaker one, he himself knew what persecution meant. There wasn't a single Jew, the most powerful Jew, who did not taste and experience persecution. And the experience of persecution itself is already a mitigating circumstance. And if I experience something unpleasant on the part of someone who is more powerful than I cannot simply pass on this experience to a person who is subordinated to me. Sometimes psychologically you say the one who is weaker out in his office so becomes a tyrant at home. But this is basically an exception. That's why the Jews were persecuted race simply felt, had compassion for the weak. But if the Jew should become not a persecutor, but an equal to others, how will he act? I don't know. I hope he'll act differently. I hope that such laws as such committees as are un-American, they are committed on American activities, and such a distorted law as the law pertaining the one pertaining to immigration, cannot be passed by the Knesset in Israel. But to tell you, I'm going to take a note now. For that, I would be a bit over optimistic. some voices I hear sometimes in the debates in the Knesset, which I dislike. I mean, it's just I'm thinking out aloud. It's not a part of my lecture. And to me, this is the most important problem. The Jew of the diaspora should be proud of Israel, regardless of what, if one is a Zionist or he does not affiliate himself with the political movement. But still, Israel is Jewish, I mean. If we don't consider Israel Jewish, at least the outside community considers Israel Jewish, I mean. It's certainly a Jewish institution. Never mind what our feelings toward Israel are. And the question is not whether Israel will defeat the Arabs on the field of battle. I'm very proud of that. But this is not, I mean, after all, a victorious army is not exclusively a Jewish, so to say, institution, I mean. Whether we'll defeat our evil within our own community, we'll be victorious in this field. To me, this is the most important problem with God is on. To say what will happen, one has got to be a prophet, I don't know. Okay. Of course.
Do you think that is possible in a state which may turn socialistic, secularistic, to be still socialistic, secularistic, and live up to the Judaic principle?
I'll tell you, I believe that one of my topics, whether I'll reach this topic today or not, is the problem of the non-religious Jew. Well, when I'll come to this topic, I'll discuss the problem. did you mention it?
Yes.
Yeah, but I don't know whether I'll get to it. I mean, I cannot make...
You said something else before we're concerned about. You said something about the modern man is not interested in the individual, and that the small individual doesn't count as much as the large individual. That's not a concept of modern man today, that we don't have this sort of thing. That's only an old Judaic concept. I thought you said it. Did you say
something? Yes, I say all modern man, his quest for democracy, has not simply, I mean, introduced equality as to the words of individuals.
Except for this, we as social workers like to talk of ourselves about being interested in the dignity of every individual and every human being.
Yes, correct. But I'll tell you, I mean, as social workers, you deal with small people, basically. Because big people don't need help.
But they give us the money to give help.
Yeah, oh yeah. I would like to ask you, I mean, and please excuse my arrogance, perhaps I become a bit impudent, about your inner feelings when someone comes to you and you're a consultant, one who needs help, a poor man. Okay. Yeah. So you have the same approach to him as you have if you have when you talk, for instance, to the governor of the state, to Nelson Rockefeller. I mean, I would ask you to do a bit of soul searching. I mean, the same approach. Do you feel emotionally, I mean, that you treat this one just like you were?
It should be a very poor professor who was teaching me something.
Yes.
I'd have the same reaction.
A poor professor whom you consider a scholar? Yeah, because then he's a big person in your eyes. Because he had contributed
and
to society.
And the poor little Muhammad who comes in, he's no great man of the community.
Yes.
He's just an ordinary, fine little man, but he has something, that's all. Because we see in every individual something.
You should see it. You should see at least. I mean, it's more a norm than a fact, I would say. It's an ideal. I mean, I'm speaking as a rabbi. I certainly supposed to see in everybody, so the reflection of our father Abraham, I mean, of course, yes, I should, but I don't. With regard to me, there is quite a gulf between practice and ideal, I mean, and I believe the same gulf, I mean, could be found in the field of social work. Isn't that possible? I know that when I speak to a person who is powerful, not that I'm afraid of him, I'm not afraid of him, I don't need his favor. But when I speak to a person who is prominent as a scientist, as a political figure, or to a man who is prominent in the field of economic accomplishment, it's rich. Not that I need anything. I always discover myself, to my own surprise, a sense of reverence. When I take a taxi and I give a tip to the cabman, there's no reverent attitude on my part. I mean, that is just what I discover about myself. I mean, I believe that this experience, it can be universalized and generalized, not like everybody. I mean, because I'm not worse about it, nor am I better. And they say, and Judaism was pressing this point vigorously, passionately. Now, of course, and this again, as I said last time, because men, we have, as I said, there are two personalities. There's the charismatic personality, as I say, charismatic Adam.
Who works for society, contributes to society, communicates his ideas, and there is numinous Adam, Adam alone. Of course, the content of the intimate, unique, personal, existential experience cannot be communicated to others. The individual, despite his most sincere efforts to reveal himself, remains hidden within himself. As regards the cardinal aspects of his personality, however, we all know that other fellows possess something worthwhile that we miss, and that we owe the other fellow, however small he is, respect and consideration, because there is something in the smallest of fellows which we don't possess. What it is, hard to say. This is the uniqueness, his personality, that Salamarki. Basically, because no one is dispensable, replaceable. Any individual is indispensable, according to Judaism. You cannot replace individual. I can't replace this mic. I can't replace a horse. But there is only the class concept. Individual does not need, does not require the class in order to, so say, to attain legitimate existence. No class or no society should has to confer, so to say, to bestow upon him its grace and benevolence and declare him an equal. He is equal because he possesses something unique. And that's why the contribution is not a determining factor. The determining factor is the existential experience.
And who knows who has a deeper existential experience, and who has a warmer heart, and who has a more tender soul? The great philosopher Kant, or a pauper or a beggar? It's very hard to say. It's the famous statement in Talmud, "Mai chazid edamach sumek tfei v'yomodamach dechavre sumek." How do you know that your blood is red? Perhaps the blood of your fellow man, your neighbor, is redder. Is more red. It's not a question of redness of the blood. Who knows who is greater, you and or I? Measured by contributions, there are objective criteria by which we can judge the greatness of a person. Measured by the inner experience, there are no criteria. Only God can measure, not human beings. This is exactly what it is.
Rabbi, you used the word a great deal, existentialist experience.
I didn't say existentialist experience, because existentialist experience means the experience of the existentialist. I'm not an existentialist, so I cannot know. I said existential experience.
Can you help me with this?
It's the experience that we call the ego consciousness, the ego awareness, that I am the experience of the I. Of the I. But when we say existentialist experience means the experience of the existentialist philosopher, it's already a doctrine. I say existential experience, the experience of my own existence, you understand? That I am, who am I? As I said last lecture, because no one can answer the question, who I am. I can answer the question, who I am in terms of contributions. If it's a question of mass and energy equation, I cannot answer the question, who I am in terms of intrinsic worth. I always can answer who I am with regard to others. I cannot answer who I am with regard to myself. There is, again, I must refer to Peretz. I think a lot about him, although he was ideologically, was a secular Jew, I'm a religious Jew. There is a novel, a short story by him. It's called The Meshuggah Battle, and I don't know how to translate. This is the technical, it's a bit clumsy, I would say. A battle means a man, bottle means to idle, not to contribute. The man who didn't contribute anything, I mean. Yeshiv bottle means a man didn't do anything. It's playboys, but not in sense of playboys, I mean.
A
loafer. A loafer, not loafer. Loafer has a certain derogatory, so to say, meaning. But it's not derogatory. A man who is not fitted into the world to serve society. I mean, misfit.
The German Taugenicht.
Yes, Taugenicht is, and it's not bad, and it's a bit resembles, there's a little resemblance.
Well, that's an example of our inability to communicate feelings.
Yes, we are about all that. So, and the whole question with the Michigan Butland, Parrot says, who am I? Who am I? It means it begins, of course, in his primitive manner. Here in this little town, this little village, people know me. Why they know me? They know my address, they know my name, they know my jacket, they know my suit, I mean, they know my hat, so they recognize me. But who am I? Am I the suit I wear? Am I the house I'm residing in? It means, am I dead? Can I be explained to others in terms of the externals of contributions? Or my existence expresses itself in more intrinsic terms, in inwardness. So what does my inwardness stand for? And this is a question which is many times disturbing me as well. I don't consider myself a butler, but it's a question. Am I only that what I appear to others to be? I'm more than that. Now, Judaism, in formulating its social ethic, and I tell you again, gentlemen, I have to beg your pardon. Whatever I say is to me it's truism. It's simple, it is commonplace. But somehow, and I don't believe that there is anything new, but I have to speak about it, because something most elementary and most axiomatic things are many times unknown, or not so much unknown, they haven't been spelled out. That's all. But they're axiomatic in Judaism. Judaism, in formulating its social ethic, was particularly concerned with human dignity and the awareness of self-worthiness. Self-worthiness. One of the most basic rights of the individual, we have many rights, basic rights. Oh, sorry. American Declaration of Independence, the Constitution is based on natural life, so-called lex naturae, about the 17th century spoke so much, I mean, the Stoa, the Roman Stoics. But there is a certain right which, I don't know, Judaism has formulated, and I haven't found this such a formula in any other system of ethics. One of the most basic rights of the individual is the right to know and to experience personal dignity and worth in living. The right to dignity. We have the right to work, not in the sense of which the legislation bills are being introduced in the various legislatures, but I mean the right to work, the right to defense, the self-defense, the right to live. But the right to dignity, what does it mean? Anyone who interferes with the intrinsic prerogative of men and injures one's self-respect, they inflict injury not on the body. Body injury, everybody understands. I must not. But I inflict injury upon the self-respect of a person who will be severely punished by God. To insult to one's neighbor or to hurt his pride, and don't please interpret it in terms of libel and slander. Not slander, not libel. Slander or libel is something else. Slander or libel means if I indict him, if I accuse him of something he didn't do, all right, it's not spreading malicious rumors, just an unintentional injury. I mean, inflicted upon his pride, an insult. To hurt his pride or embarrass him, even causing embarrassment, particularly if this embarrassment is caused to him in public, in the presence of others, is equated by our moral code as murder. Yes, I mean, I'm not exaggerating. Correct, yes. And let us not forget, and I'll tell you why it was classified as murder. Let us not forget that the Hebrew term for murder is shvichut damim. Bloodshed. And under this heading, under semantically, when you say bloodshedding or bloodshed, any painful experience, the Halacha understood that any painful experience which causes a flash of anger, shame, or sudden paling of a frightened face is an act of bloodshed. Because what is mean Malbin? Malbin Hebrew means one pales. Oh, I pale, I felt embarrassed. I felt frightened. I felt injured. I felt hurt. There's a change in the blood circulation, the temper of blood circulation. You see, paling and is a flash of anger shame, or sudden paling of a frightened face is an act of murder. And the famous expression, Kol ha-malbim pnei chaveri barabim, whoever shames his, not only shame, hurts the pride of his friend, of his neighbor in public, he is treated or penalized as if he had committed murder and had killed him. And the Talmud continues and said, Noach leilo Adam, shiyapil atzmo lekif shanayesh, val yaldem tnei chaveri barabim. One should incur rather martyrdom than embarrass his comrade in public. Amalbim pnei chaveri barabim ein lechelek leilam haba. Whoever shames his neighbor in the presence of others will not share in the world to come. Bliss in the world to come, beatitude in the future world, are denied to one who shamed his friend. It's interesting. It was not denied to the murderer, but it was denied to the one who shamed his friend. Because shaming a friend in public is many times more subtle and more cruel than to kill a person. This was the opinion. So the right to dignity is many times was placed above the right to live. Although, gentlemen, the right to self-respect was bestowed by the Creator upon everyone without, upon the king and upon the papa, special emphasis was placed upon the dignity of the humble. Of course, the king is also. I mean, to shame the president of the United States is not a very ethical deed. And believe me, many times when I read the press, I listen to pre-election campaign speeches. Of course, they speak about the most powerful person in the United States. But many times, I think, I try to take, for instance, a speech, a Texas speech, the Times always accommodates me, and just red pencil certain lines and try to classify them under Jewish ethical categories. What are Talmudic scholars would have thought if they had read a speech delivered about anybody? Shaming, insulting, hurting, abusing. No good purpose, perhaps. But this is not... many times I think how is within the framework of Jewish ethics, a political campaign is complete impossibility. Impossibility. Because when even our people in Israel, when they get engaged, become engaged in the political campaign, and they are not sure there either of invectives and compliments and about opponents. So they are not Jews anymore. They're not Jews. It's not Jewish. I'm sorry, but political campaign is not a Jewish institution. It's not always not a Jewish institution. It's completely abhorrent to the religious conscience. It's not only you must not say falsehoods, you must not hurt anybody if you tell the truth. This business of exposing a person, it's a good piece of journalism, of course. People get the Pulitzer Prize for that. But from a Judaic viewpoint, it is something which is obnoxious, repulsive. It's a crime. This is the real Amalbim Pnei Chaveri Barabim, shaming one in the public, either a larger public than the one which read the press, and even with regard to truthfulness.
Somebody has done something genuinely wrong.
It's a good question. Of course, such type of idealism may many times be exploited in order to tolerate evil. Correct, you are right. But there are limits. For instance, if the person, what do you call, becomes a roide, if it means he's a menace to public safety, then you expose him, but also when you expose the wicked, there are many ways of exposing him. You don't dramatize it, you don't play it up, I mean, you know, you don't try to appeal to the lower instinct of the crowd. I mean, you know how journalism, particularly the yellow type, I mean, does such things. But there's got to be a menace to public safety. What is called Reudish in Hebrew, I mean, a menace, who without being a menace to public safety. I'll give you an example. For instance, you know what it means in Jewish life, meant a musser. You know what a musser is? One who squeals. Squealer. Squeals, informer. Of course, I mean, in Middle Ages, I mean, the informer was the most despicable individual. I mean, he was a public menace, no doubt about it. Yes, it's interesting. So Moser always, the Jews reconcile, I mean, interpreted Moser in terms of passing down information to the enemy. This is correct. This is basically espionage, the enemy. And since the Jews in the Middle Ages were surrounded by enemies, so any information passed down to the authorities was classified as betrayal, as espionage and misservice. But basically, Jewish ethicists say that even if there is a Jewish state, if there were a Jewish state, and one knows of something, of a crime which his neighbor committed, a crime in which public safety is not involved, I want you to know, but it's a crime, he has no right to inform the Jewish authorities either. You are not a judge.
In other words, how about a witness in the trial?
You are right.
In a civil matter.
Unless he's summoned.
He has no right to offer to appeal.
In civil matters, civil matters, in money matters, yes. In money matters, first of all, he has no right. He is not obligated unless he's summoned by the party which is interested. But money matters, many times, simply is not informing. It's a question only of pertaining to a deal, I mean, where the person himself is not involved in that. The question in criminal matters, is basically most scholars say, unless the best din, the court, forces him to testify. He must not volunteer information. Unless this type of crime is endangered simply, the lives of other individuals. Then it's a different story. In general, Judaism has grappled with the problem of judging people. Even the problem of a court was a mystery to Jews. How can a Jew judge his fellow man? Is he perfect that he can pass on judgment upon others? And that's why the position of the Dayan, of the so-called justice, judge, is a very precarious one in Jewish ethics. The Talmud says a judge should see himself as if hell, the purgatory, is underneath, and divine wrath up from above. It's a very unpleasant position, you see, to be between the devil and the blue sea, you see. And many times when I've never been in court, but when I read about the reasoning which accompany any sentence, then I feel that the judge considers himself, he's so complacent about himself, and he considers himself perfect and entitled to pass on judgment on others. I always think about the Jewish approach to the judge. And that's why the Talmudic scholars recommended that no one should accept the judgeship, an appointment as a judge, because it's something inhuman in that. Only one has a right to judge people, and this is God, no one else. And basically, judging people is an evil with which the halacha, which was realistic, had to come to terms. You see, many things in Judaism is not that were not liked, and Judaism accepted them reluctantly. But what could you do? After all, we need a society, we need some assemblies of order, we need a state. Otherwise, it would be war of all against all, in the expression of Hobbes, you see.
I understand it was quite a struggle within Jewish circles around the Rosenberg trial and Judge Kaufman and his
efforts. Yes?
Yeah, I understand a few of the rabbis tried to get to him to discuss with him the Jewish ethics of Jewish
point of view. It was very wrong at his part. Extremely wrong. Basically, I believe that in the case of the Rosenberg trial, I don't believe that the men who are so stupid as to give a death sentence for espionage in peacetime would believe, huh? Wouldn't it? Because, I mean, we simply were small people. It was the amount of damage they did to the safety of the United States could not be determined. And when this famous atomic scientist in England, Fuchs, I mean, betrayed, so certainly, I mean, if Russia had taken advantage of our research, indeed, I mean, information came to them through Fuchs, but not through small, ignorant people. I mean, this was terrible. In my opinion, it was murder. Bloodshed and murder. Also,
aren't you, in a sense, judging yourself now?
Yes, you're right. I shouldn't say that. You're right. Mea maxima
culpa.
Mea maxima culpa, my sins, of course. Yes, you're right. You're certainly right. You're right. I'm not denying it. You're right. But sometimes you can't suppress.
The judge was there to do it. The only difference.
What can you do? What can you do? I mean, he did not do a service to the United States, certainly not. He did not enhance the prestige of the United States, nor did he enhance, so to say, the security of the United States. The United States is secure enough. There's no need for it. Of course, it was the McCarthy atmosphere, I mean, this hysterical, I mean, climate, and fear, simply. He was afraid. And what bothers my mind is that, what he said when I can't fall asleep at night, I think, what if this judge were not a Jew, but a Christian, would he have? I mean, end up a death sentence. And I'm inclined to say no.
Suppose his wife's name wasn't Rosenberg.
Huh? Beg your pardon? And suppose, from the other end. And suppose, I mean, the two little people who were not Jews. It was an unfortunate coincidence of a Jew versus a Jew. And that's what disturbs me more than anything else.
Is that from a Jewish point of view that you're objecting to this thing, or from some other point of view? Is it part of halakha, for instance, that this thing, that man, no man should have judged at all? That this was the wrong judgment?
The severity of the judge, of this sentence. I'm not criticizing the sentence itself. And this is a Jewish viewpoint. I don't say you should take a spies and tell them just compliment them or give them a reward. I mean, they should be locked up for a while, no doubt about that. But, I mean, in general, death penalty, now according to the lucky concept, is an impossibility almost.
The question I brought in, the fact is that he indicated, Judge Kaufman indicated, that he looked at his God.
Oh, this is exactly what I don't like.
Judgment.
About this case.
And that's why I believe Rabbi Rachman and perhaps others went to see him in terms of trying to interpret his God, if you will,
right.
He was appealing to a greater...
This is exactly what I disliked about it, the story that he walked into the temple and consulted his God. But it's a funny God he consulted. It's a McCarthy God, not a Jewish God. I don't know whether the man was sincere or not. I'll tell you things I don't know him. I have no right to judge, as you said. Well, since you pressed me for an answer. Yes?
Therefore, we do have a right to question whether, in terms of the statement that we're holding around the table that the judge had made, whether this was and is in line with...
Yes.
And in what way can you rationalize, if you will, that this is possible?
What's possible? Rationalize
position that he took.
No, to me, it's not rational.
Obviously, many of us around the table say that it is not possible, but he took.
To introduce Judaism, the God of Israel, into this, so to say, institution, the death penalty, for small people who apparently did not do much damage to the safety of the United States, this was not unwarranted.
The less relevant to one's kerygma is, it means his message to society, his contribution, the more concerned society must be with his inner pride and dignity.
This is the Judaic concept. Do you have a Bible, in English?
Yes.
Yes. If you'll take Leviticus 19:14, gentlemen. 1914. You have it? Excuse me, gentlemen. Yes. Yes, 1914. Thou shalt not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind, but shalt fear thy God. I am the Lord. You shalt not curse the deaf, and you should not put a stumbling block before the blind. You shall fear thy God. I am the Lord. It means I don't tolerate it. The deaf and blind, why only the deaf? Am I allowed, permitted to curse anybody who still can hear the curse uttered? Certainly not. But with the deaf one, against whom nature has discriminated, the cripple, Judaism has a unique approach with regard to that one. The deaf and the blind are representative of a class of people handicapped physically and socially anonymous. Because a deaf person can't accomplish much, unless he's an Edison or a Beethoven, and lonely. The Torah singles them out. Be careful not to vex or cause any harm to them. First. Then, for instance, if we'll take another sentence, so I'll tell you just where it is. Just a minute. Yes, it is Exodus 23. Exodus 23:20. Exodus 23:20. Chapter 23, verse 20. Thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Ye shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry. And my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. Very severe words. Yes, sir.
The anti-Maimonidean controversy, the Karaite Rabbanite controversy, the Hasidic Elijah Gordon versus Yitzhak.
Yeah.
Would that be included within the Malbin Nechavel or not?
You mean certain acts on the part of the rabbinate against dissidents, yes?
Over through the centuries we've had
it. Against dissidents. Against dissidents. Yeah. Perhaps yes. I'll be very frank with you. Perhaps yes. Perhaps it was wrong. Regardless of the fact that such a great authority as the Gaon of Vilna did it. Regardless of that. I don't believe it was in conformity with Jewish ethics.
My question is, a statement like that is a wish, an ideal, a flash, which has not become rooted as such in Jewish life, or whether it was a guiding principle.
You are right. Whether it's just an ideal, Christianity has many ideals which have never been put into effect. Yes, a good question. I believe, and I am very objective about it, I try to treat it in a detached manner. It's no use, I mean, romanticizing our past, or trying to weave, our fantasy should weave a halo around our heroes. I believe with certain exceptions, more or less, it was reality. Yeah. With certain exceptions. Of course, human beings, however great, cannot control themselves. But with certain exceptions, yes. Thou shalt neither, yes, all right, yes. Why widow and orphan, they shouldn't oppress anybody. Why only the widow and orphan? Why only not to vex the stranger? And the resident citizen, you're allowed to vex? You're allowed to annoy, you're allowed to embarrass? No, I mean, the law, my mind says the law applies to everybody. But why did the Torah single out the stranger, the orphan, and the widow? The answer I said before, the widow, the orphan, the stranger are typical of a class of people who are defenseless, weak, and occupy a very anonymous station in society. It is the symbol of anonymity. And there is specific emphasis placed upon hurting the anonymous individual. Because if you hurt the president of the United States, you can recover from the shock. But if you hurt an anonymous individual, the shock can be so powerful still never recover from. I mean mentally, emotionally. Maimonides writes, if you want to know the source, it is Deyot. Deyot means virtues. The book which deals with virtues, 6:9. A man ought to be especially heedful of his behavior toward widows and orphans, for their souls are exceedingly depressed and their spirits low. One must not speak to them, address himself to them, otherwise than tenderly. One must show them unwavering courtesy, not hurt them physically with hard toil, nor wound their feelings or hurt with harsh words. Whoever irritates them, provokes them to anger, pains them, tyrannizes them, or even shames them, or hurts their pride, is guilty of a transgression, and still more so if one beats them or curses them. Again, the station of the non-prominent citizen. Remarkable is a story revealed in the Michilta. It's a midrash. It's a strange story. It's very typical. You know the history of the 10 martyrs, I mean, the famous Asara, Rugi, Malchut, I mean, the 10 martyrs during the Roman occupation of Palestine. Among them were the greatest Jewish scholars like Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Yishmael. I mean, actually the fathers of the Talmud, of Talmudic halakhic Judaism. I mean, martyrs, because, I mean, there was a wave of religious persecution and they did not conform to the Roman edict prohibiting enjoining Jews from practicing their religion. So the story, and it looks to be quite historical. The story is mentioned twice, once in the Michilta and another Talmudic book. When Rabban Gamliel was the Duke of the Jews, it was simply occupied the place of the king, the prince. He was called Rabban Gamliel the prince. And Rabbi Ishmael, the high priest, he was the high priest, who were sentenced to death and taken to the place of execution, Rabban Gamliel, the prince, began suddenly to sob, to cry. Rabbi Ishmael, it's almost a literal translation, addressed himself to his colleague and said, I mean, it's literal, Prince in Israel, Nisi Israel, I mean, that's anyway. Prince in Israel, why do you cry? Just a few steps separate us, or thou, thee, from our Father in heaven. And he said it, I mean, in Hebrew it's still nicer. In a few short moments, you'll be sitting in the lap of the Shekhinah. You know what Shekhinah means? This is divinity as a mother. Divinity symbolized as a mother, not as a father. Rabban Gamliel answered, I'm not frightened by the prospect of death. I'm not afraid of the tortures. I cry because we are going to be executed like ordinary criminals, while we did not commit any offense for which we would have to suffer the death penalty. Simply, he doesn't understand why he's killed. We ask the question, why? A martyr, a saint, about to incur, I mean, to sacrifice himself on the altar for the perpetuation of Jewish tradition and Jewish people, and they are the ones who saved the Jewish people from disintegration at that time. They actually, by their example, by their fortitude and boldness. Yes. So I mean, ask a question. It's a question, what do you call a question which belongs in theodicy, the problem of evil. Why? Why did God do that? So Rabbi Ishmael answered, and the answer is very typical and said, my prince and master of the world, Nisi Yisrael Rabbi Umeri, my prince and master and teacher, permit me to say something to you. So Rabbi Gamliel said, all right, go on. Perhaps once you were taking an afternoon nap, and while you were dozing off, a poor woman with a loaf of bread came into your house to inquire of you whether or not the bread was clean or unclean. It means now we say, we come with the problem of meat, whether the meat is kosher or not kosher. In that period, they observe the laws of cleanliness with regard to bread. So whatever, when a poor woman calls the rabbi, I mean, comes into the rabbi with a chicken to take a look and say whether the chicken is kosher, at that time, they didn't speak about chickens, about fowl, they spoke about kikot, I mean, loaves of bread. Whether the bread is is clean or unclean, it means fit according to the law for consumption or not. It means simply I came with a problem, whether or not it was clean or unclean, and your servant or butler told her to wait a while until you will come out of your bedroom. I mean, he went into the bedroom and wakened Rabbi Gamliel from his sleep, the prince. But of course, he can't jump out of bed and go out into the waiting room. He had to get dressed. So it took him a few moments to get dressed. And while you were dressing, the lonely widow sighed and felt hurt. She thought that if the person who came to the prince were more prominent, Rabbi Gamliel would have come out, had been more prominent, he would have come out right away. All she had to wait is 5 seconds until he got dressed. And you know, I mean, dressing in olden time didn't take as much as it takes us now. You see, you, my prince and master, know that the penalty for such a transgression, it means to oppress a widow, is varakti eschem bechorem, and I'll slay thee with the sword. You just read. That's all. This paradoxical story is very unique. Not only was every woman whose mind was bothered by a problem allowed to approach the prince in Israel, apparently there was no telephone, no appointment, either way up. I mean, if Rabbi Gamliel had received visitors by appointment only, the whole problem couldn't have developed. You see, she opened the door and walked in. And Rabbi Gamliel, not an ordinary rabbi, this was the king of Israel, the prince. You see, upper the prince and master of the Jewish community, and none was barred from the gate of the palace, whether he lived in the palace or not, I don't know, in a humble hut. But the prince was duty-bound to receive her at once, not to let her wait, lest she might feel hurt. Moreover, the Torah expects the prince to leave strict instructions with his valet that he must wake him up in a case of inquiry is made by some unknown person, then he must step out right away, I mean immediately, of his bedroom in order, I mean, to attend to business. And the penalty for it is death. Of course, it is almost impractical. I mean, impractical. Impractical. It is an ideal. But, you see, you know, we see about the Talmud was a bit Freudian about dreams. He said, the Talmud also said, dreams reflect the personality. Ideals also reflect the religious conscience.
It means we shouldn't have any waiting list scenarios.
Sure, I mean that. I mean, but I, instead of addressing myself to you, I should address myself to myself. I shouldn't let people wait. I'm just a sinner as all of us.
But somehow I think evil can come from others, can come as a result of a very puritanical kind of attitude towards living in.
Yeah, you mean if men should become completely not critical, so to say, and accept everybody? Yes, of course. But as I said to you before, Judaism has also, you see, Judaism operates with two valid, so it means with the thesis and antithesis, I mean. I'll come with regard to the community, what Judaism requires, I mean, because it simply sometimes immobilizes and paralyzes action, I mean, this tender approach. But it is in Judaism. I'm just reporting, nothing else. And I say reporting about elementary things, I mean, there's nothing which I... This manifestation of peculiar considerateness, perseverance, and tenderness toward the lowly and meek ones on the part of Judaic ethics can only be understood if seeing the light of the imitatio Dei idea, that man should imitate God. I emphasized in my previous lecture, or perhaps two lectures before, that man can reach God only as a forlorn, helpless, lonely being, not as a powerful being. If man comes into the temple or into the synagogue as a judge, as Kaufman did, so he has no contact with God. A judge is an authority. His wields power, there is no contact with God. Man endowed with power cannot approach God. Who can approach God? The man who is stripped of everything, forgotten by everyone. Man forsaken and forgotten by everyone. No company, no friendship, save God. Only God. The prophets emphasized time and again that God, the master of creation, of the great cosmic drama, of the innumerable galaxies and the uncharted lanes of the universe, humbles himself to commune with the individual and abide in the tents of the poor and the oppressed. Sustenance of reality as a whole, in total, on the one hand, and support of the lonely person on the other hand, are two pursuits in which God engages with equal concern and love. And, for instance, we'll take Isaiah. Where is it? Yes, it's Isaiah, the last chapter. It is 46. No, it's 66. 66, verse 1 and 2. Correct? Thus says the Lord, the heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. It means complete mastery over the universe. Where is the house that ye build unto me? And where is the place of my rest? It means God is infinite. For all those things have my hand made, and all those things have been, says the Lord, but to this man will I look, even to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit, and trembles at my word. Both, on the one hand, infinity, what we call in Hebrew is Pashtus, God is infinite, and God can become so small, so we say it infinitesimal, that he can come in the low tent of the poor person. Kabbalah call it, it's Ein Sof, means infinity, and Tzimtzum, complete contraction on the part of God. He fits in into the smallest tent. He doesn't fit in into the cosmos, he fits also in into the smallest room. God exalted over all creation, far and transcendent, is concerned with the poor and contrite spirit. He seeks the company of the lonely and addresses himself to him. Now I ask you, Now, at the end, interesting is, at the exit of the Shabbos, of the Sabbath, it's very interesting.
That out as Esau too.
Yeah, at the conclusion of the Sabbath, it's very interesting. When a Jew actually, recites the prayer, the first prayer of the weekday, of Chol. So at the end of this prayer, so the Jew quotes a passage from the Talmud. Rabbi Yochanan said, wherever you find the Lord's greatness mentioned, you find his gentleness indicated. This is so in the Torah, again in the prophets, and the third time in the Psalms. It is written in the Torah, the Lord your God is the supreme God, the supreme Lord, the great God, mighty and revered, who is never partial and never takes a bribe. And immediately afterward, it says, he secures justice for the orphan and the widow, and loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Great! But the great God humbles himself to be the companion of the stranger. Can the President of the United States invite himself some foreigner if he's not a diplomat? I mean, even Even about Roosevelt, I mean, I read, I don't know whether it was true or not, Farley wrote it, but I take it as true that Mrs. Roosevelt said once to him, my husband cannot relax in company of such people who are culturally not equals, his equals. I mean, it's a very natural statement, there's nothing derogatory about it. I cannot relax either, I mean, a company, I mean, of people who are culturally below me. And I imagine someone is superior to me cannot relax in my company. So there is not democracy. But God, the greatest of all, can relax, if I may use this word, perhaps blasphemous, but I may use the word, relax in the company of the ignorant, poor, and lowly. Again it is written in the prophets, thus says the high and lofty one, who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place, and immediately sing to God, sing praises to his name, extol him, who is in heaven, Lord is his name, and exalt before him. And immediately afterward it says, a father of orphans, a champion of widows, is God in his holy habitation. This combination. A man should not only be high, he should be Lord. He should be not all of his culture, sometimes uncultured, be able to speak with the most primitive person. This is an ability, gentlemen. As a rabbi, I know, I couldn't. Sometimes with primitive press, particularly in religion, person comes with such primitive ideas. Primitive ideas, superstition. Of course, I mean, sometimes the boundary line between religious lofty ideals and superstition is simply so blurred that people don't know. And it come to me many times with such foolish questions, and many times I display impatience. A woman comes to me, her husband died, and she is afraid that the spirit of her husband still abides in her home, because at night she puts away the dishes, and then she finds the dishes in a different place. Of course, it's a question of arteriosclerosis. I mean, she simply forgets. She's an elderly woman, she forgets. She herself puts away the dishes. Yeah, of course, you see. So, I mean, there can be different attitudes on the part of the rabbi how to treat this woman. You see, it's a question of patience. And patience is always, of course, you can train yourself to be patient, I believe. Self-aware don't need any instruction in that. But it's also a question of axiological appraisal, how you appraise her. If you look upon her as your equal, because she has intrinsic worth, you and I will be patient. But if you look down upon her and him, then patience is a very difficult virtue. Man. You have to constrain yourself to be patient. And the idea is not to constrain oneself to be patient. The idea refers to inner esteem, gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, to inner esteem, to appreciate the lower spirit as perhaps as noble, as my, so to say, sophisticated spirit. This is exactly what Judaism is. Not only perseverance. Perseverance can be a mechanical just quality, I mean synthetic.
Judaism didn't believe in sin. On the contrary, Judaism did not believe that life would cover up feelings. Because this is hypocrisy, this is already lying, it's falsity. But it should be ingrained in the person to have compassion, not only compassion for his fellow man, not only mercy, but also reverence. Now I'll come again to our writer, secular writer, Peretz. He wrote a short story. You will just translate it almost in all European languages, and it's well known. The story is called Bunch of Schweine. You heard of this story. Bunch of Schweig is to say Bunch is a name, and Schweig means the silent bunch, but it means more than silent bunch. And whoever, I'll tell you frankly, you won't have to live in a small Jewish town in Lithuania or Poland in order to appreciate Bunch of Schweig. In America, you haven't seen that. Because in America, such a Bunch of Schweig would be classified by the agency as a retarded child and put away. There would be no Bunch of Schweig, I mean, walking the streets of the town. Bunch of Schweig usually is developed when a retarded child was born. And they couldn't attend cheder, I mean, you know, the school. I mean, if you attended, I mean, it was, I mean, his instructions were completely useless and worthless. So he grew up to be a the moron of the town. What you call in Yiddish, Ashtad Mishigana. Sometimes they were very noisy, sometimes they were quiet, mute. I knew such a man, who used to call him as a child, I remember, I was six years old, in a small town in Russia, used to call him Alta Dana, Alta the name, Alta the moron.
So what you did the altar do? Altar for instance, and Moran inherited a few hundred dollars from his father, so he or someone borrowed the money from him. So he used to receive, he was supposed to receive interest, of course. So the interest he used to receive is that he used to draw water and chop wood for the men who borrowed his money. I mean, this was it was an institution in the small towns in Lithuania. This is Bontish life. Otherwise, it's hard to appreciate the story. So, of course, if there is a person who, if there is a person who did not contribute, could not contribute anything to society, of the lowest station, this is the type of Bontish life, or as I call it, Alta de Moran, the Moran of the town Moran. So Peretz writes, the death of Bontish life made no impression. No one knew or cared to know. I had to translate it because I gave away the book earlier I had before. It is in Elena Frank's You'll Find the Translation, but this I did because I didn't have the book. No one knew or cared to know who Bontish was, how he lived, and what was the cause of his death. Did he suffer a heart attack? Did his strength give out? Or did his spine collapse under the heavy loads he was wont to carry? I mean, not being paid for them, of course. I mean, for all we know, he might have died of hunger. And this is the most probable thing. Bontish lived quietly and died quietly. He passed through our world like a shadow. At the circumcision of Bontish, the boys of Bontish, there was no clatter of wine glasses.
No wine, no whiskey was drunk.
No address was delivered at his bar mitzvah. And no brilliant speeches were made. His life was gray and undistinguishable from the lives of millions of men around him. As one particle of sand, he is not different, he is not distinguishable from the millions of particles of sand at the beach. And no one noticed when the wind carried a particle of sand across the sea. The beach remains the same. Bontish left no footprints in the mud. He well lived. And after his death, the wind carried the small marker of his grave away. The wife of the gravedigger found it in at some distant place away, picked it up, built with it a fire on which she cooked potatoes. 3 days later, his death and not even his grave digger. His death was forgotten and not even his grave digger knew where he buried him. If there is a masterly description of anonymity about anonymity which the Halacha spoke, Peretz gave it. But there is, he was born quietly, he lived in silence, he died mutely, and he was buried noiselessly. This is all right. Now comes, so to say, the finale. God, it's a long story. In heaven it was quite different. In heaven it was quite different. There, his death made a profound impression. The big shofar of Messiah sounded aloud and announced throughout the seven heavens, Bontish Schweig has died, and he's coming into heaven. The most prominent among the angels whispered to each other, Bontish was summoned before the court of the Most High. The great Bontish is coming. Paradise was in uproar. Such joy, such an excitement, it is no mean matter. Bontish Schweig was coming. He expressed in a few sentences what I tried to express unsuccessfully in believing almost in an hour. That's all. This situation. And the end of the story, Peretz says, how little he was that when he came before the heavenly tribunal, and he told him all the treasures,
every type of bliss, spiritual beatitude is his. All he asks is for a warm wall with his butter every day. It means his imagination was so limited. That's all. And still he was great, great in his muteness, because he had something. He has tenderness, he has something. The inner worth is not measured by his foolish behavior. Not even on earth, by his foolish behavior in heaven. Yes, sir.
I don't think our problem is so much the attitude of us, though the simple. I think those people more likely bring out the best in us, or the better in us. The attitude is toward the arrogant, the haughty, the indecent. What, will you cover that later?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But Dr. Eisenberg, aren't you all arrogant?
Haughty? There are gradations, of course. No,
haughty?
I don't think so. I don't think quite.
I am. As far as I'm concerned, I can speak all that myself, but I am at many times arrogant.
You're probably tempering your arrogance with a lot of self-criticism.
Certainly. Yeah. I'll give an example. I deliver in the classroom. I deliver my lecture.
Who does not see is arrogant.
You mean who does not do any soul searching? I mean, this is unmitigated arrogance. But it's still, but I am also arrogant, but many times. And I promise myself I would never do that again. And I trip and fall.
Well, we have a given King David and Jacob and other people a place in our...
Certainly, in our pantheon, yes.
Because these are the people who struggle with themselves. And wasn't that the idea?
Yes, Dr. Eisenberg, I'll come to the problem one struggle with himself later. I'll take up this problem. You are right. A man cannot be born perfect. It's an eternal struggle with himself. No, this is Judaism. Yes, it's
the Judaism, though, this concept of the concern for the lowly and the...
Yes, of course, you'll take the gospel. The heaven, the gates of heaven, open only for the meek.
Blessed
are the meek. Yes. But first of all, what the gospel said, particularly in this regard, was taken from Judaism. No theologian now, I want you to understand, no theologian now, in his, so to say, his sane theologian, in his ordinary senses, a man who does not, will say that these chapters of the gospel, who were invented by Christ, they were taken from the Jewish ethic. Number one. Number two is something else is important. Important is, it's a chapter in the gospel. To us, it wasn't only a chapter in the gospel. It was to some extent practiced. You know, there is in Shalom Aleichem a story, and the name of the story is called Mir is good, Yir bin Yosef. I feel well or good, I feel good that because I'm an orphan. It means he's somehow immune to anything. This is very typical. It's very typical of the Jewish mentality. It's very typical of the Jewish mentality. You see, literature describes it. We were very careful about it. I mean, our rabbis, I can tell you that. Please don't classify me because I'm already half Americanized and I settled the faults of American revenant. I discovered and also, I mean, seem to assimilate it. But I know I come from a rabbinical house. My grandfather, forefathers were rabbis for many generations. The democratic approach, this being accessible to everybody, this lack of arrogance, this sense of humility, it's too bad that our people don't know about it. It has not been perpetuated in literature. Sometimes you singled out the Goyen. The Goyen was also a humble person, but he was a spiritual aristocrat, basically. Basically, what, take the average rabbi, take the Hasidic rabbis. What was great about Hasidism? This democratic approach. Anybody with a torn suit. I mean, any moron. Actually, Hasidism, the beginning, it was a movement of morons. Of morons, yes. Of cultural morons. Of illiterates. Of cultural illiterates. People couldn't read, couldn't write, couldn't say their prayers. What do you call it in Yiddish? Yeshuvnikas, the people who live in the villages. The villagers. It's a moron. I mean, actually, it was a funny movement, but this was great. But basically, even before Hasidism, there was a certain democracy, because a Jew, of course, we always spoke about the Jew. The Jew was concerned with himself. why should he universalize his ideals? Although these ideals are universal, basically. The Jew felt everybody's a Jew. I am in no way, take even in no way superior, take even our arrangement in the synagogue. It was the most democratic arrangement in the synagogue. We have no clergy, that's why we have no clergy. The rabbi is a teacher. He's a servant of the community. He's not a clergyman in the sense of the Catholic priest. He has no specific metaphysical endowment. He's not invested with anything. He's just one of the crowd. He's more responsible, perhaps, but certainly has no more privileges. And that's why we can daven, we can pray, we can organize a service without the participation of the rabbi. But you cannot recite mass, the same mass, without the participation of the clergyman. This all, I mean, if you'll see the whole Judaic structure, that's why we have no authority. That's why I'm opposed to the idea of Sanhedrin in Eretz Yisrael. I'm deadly opposed to it. Perhaps Sanhedrin may serve a useful purpose now, particularly controlling the lunatic fringe within Orthodoxy. Yes, perhaps. But it means the establishment of authority, and there was complete freedom in the halacha.
There always was an aristocracy within the synagogue, within the temple, among the...
what kind of aristocracy?
We sat in certain places.
You mean the Mizrahi Meir?
Yeah, it's actually a place and you had a
That didn't mean much. Didn't mean much. And I tell you, listen, we sinned also. Quite a few sins in our...
That's Chapin's translation of Jesus.
Huh?
Good deal of this economic struggle...
Yes, of course, I mean... Now they want to see Hasidism, I mean, in terms of Marxist materialism, of historical materialism, and perhaps some elements are... We should not deny that this interpretation is completely false. I'd say that this interpretation is false. Perhaps there are a few motives correct. But you cannot... The whole Jewish society wasn't built. You don't have any aristocracy. Aristocracy is abhorrent to the Jewish conscience. Now... Yes, sir.
Well, if this is true... What is the difference in the concept of the so-called you were asked a question about prayer. You talked about the fact that the prayers were standardized for the people who there was an attempt to democratize religion.
Go ahead.
Well, wasn't this smack of a hierarchical kind of concept about man?
Hierarchical, he said.
Yes. In other words, some people, why should words be more meaningful as articulated by some people and more beautiful? You use the expression that these prayers were more beautiful. In the sight of God, why should they be more beautiful? One set of words as compared to another.
No, I didn't say that God simply discriminated between the prayer which was recited with ease in the beautiful language, beautiful vernacular, and the prayer which, I mean, this. One was incoherent. I didn't say that. All I said is that since religion must become institutionalized, we have to accommodate the illiterates as well. And to leave prayer to the individual, he should say what he feels, would be an ideal. Matter of fact, would be an ideal. But if there are many people can't express themselves. And that's why they had to standardize prayer. I mean, that's what I said. But I didn't say that a man who offers, he offers a prayer, grammatically correct and expressed in beautiful phrases, his prayer is more acceptable to God than the prayer of the illiterate. I didn't say that. Yes, I'll tell you, as far as prayer is concerned, I want to tell you something. There is a Sefer Hasidim, the book of Hasidim, but not this Hasidim. It means of the medieval Hasidim in Germany, about the 12th, 13th century. Century. There is a funny incident related that there was a shepherd near a community, near Mainz, and he was an illiterate, he couldn't pray. This story is already Hasidim also have this story, but this is an original story. He couldn't pray, so he used to see, but he was a shepherd, he used to take care of the flock, of sheep, goats particularly. Goats, I mean, the community never had, a Jew never in the Middle Ages couldn't afford to buy a cow. Cow was the only capitalist, but only goat. Only actually goat. I mean, we know that from the responsa. They had goats. Goats and sheep, lambs, sheep. So he used to take care of the goats, and the goat herd. So every morning he used to get up and say, "My God, I love you so much. I take care of the goats and the community, and I charge everybody £5 or £5 for a week. I can promise you, I'll take care of your goats, if you entrust me your goats, without any pain." this was his prayer. It's historical, isn't it? Was his prayer a strange prayer of an illiterate, primitive person? So one of the great scholars of the Balearta support of the Rashi school passed by, passed through this village, and overheard him. He was eavesdropping and overheard him in this prayer. So he began to yell, it is blasphemy. What do you mean? He said to God, I mean, he'll take care of his goats. Where God? So he said, I cannot pray. Otherwise. He said, I'll teach you just one sentence of one word. And he taught him, Shema Yisrael, Ad Hashem Elokeinu, Ad Hashem Echad. You know, Israel, God is our God, God is one. It's not difficult to repeat. Well, apparently, mind was a bit stupid and dull. He forgot it. One day he said it, the next day he forgot it. So then this scholar who once dreamt, and he said, you have committed a crime. The man prayed, and his prayer was most acceptable to God. And by your intervention, you stopped him from praying, because you told him it's blasphemy, what he said. And the Shema Yisrael was forgotten, so he doesn't say anything. The contact with him and God is being interrupted, completely discontinued. Go take a special trip to that village. Tell him to say the prayer, the old prayer. He's the best prayer. And he went and said, this is a story. I mean, Hasidim also have the same story. This shows you how Judaism has approached prayer. Of course, that's what I have against the modern temple and the modern synagogue. And I'm not discriminating between the Reformed temple or the Orthodox synagogue. I don't care. They're both wrong in Israel. There is already a hierarchy. The rabbi is a part of the hierarchy. The president is a part of the hierarchy. The board of trustees is a part of the hierarchy. Sometimes it's repulsive. When you look on what's going on in Jewish temples or synagogues, I can't say that. Now let me continue for a moment. In view of the foregoing analysis, I'm going now to take up the problem. It is, of course, this problem is to me significant, relevant, because perhaps I personally suffered a great deal from that. Let me be a bit suffered a great deal from that, and it's also a problem of the Jew in general. It's the problem of loneliness. I personally suffer. Not as a Jew, as a person. And of course, and because, you know, I mean, experience is the mother of thought. Not needed experience, the mother of invention, but experience is the mother of suffering, is the mother of thought. Thought, self-analysis, soul search. Perhaps whatever I'll say here is very subjective. It will sound half like a confession, but I believe I have enough proof. This was a Judaic approach. And basically, I was raised in a house of Jewishness, so I've absorbed many things which are not, so to say, spelled out in books, which I'm trying now to spell out from intuition. In the view of the foregoing analysis, so please, if I am a bit subjective, so ignore me. But however, I mean, I believe that this is the only approach which a Jew can take to the problem of Jewish loneliness, which should not be overlooked by any Jew. And now I'm not taking sides. Nationalistic Jew who recommends assimilation as the solution to Jewish problem, a religious Jew, a secular Jew. I don't take sides in this. I detach myself from all ideologies. But I believe that this problem of loneliness is a common denominator in all Jews. Whether it's our fault or it's the fault of our neighbors, I don't know. I don't want to indict anybody. Many times I think our gentle friends are not to be blamed. Perhaps it's our fault. But it's a fact. What I have to dwell at this problem at length, it's a psychological problem, it's depth psychology, and it's also a metaphysical problem. To me, any problem which is involved in depth psychology becomes a metaphysical problem. I believe that our experiences, our inner experiences, not the superficial experiences, the platitudinous experiences, but the intrinsic experiences, reflect metaphysical ideas. In view of the foregoing analysis, it means that I spoke about, again, numinous men for himself, and charismatic men who keeps on, who passes on a message to others. It means he contributes to society, charisma men. In the view of the foregoing analysis, we may understand better the experience, I'll call it for the time being, solitariness. I'll show you why I use this word. As a matter of fact, we may say that there are two basic feelings in man. One is the One feeling is that of loneliness. The second feeling is that of aloneness. Aloneness. If you take the adverb alone and convert it into a noun, aloneness. And let me say, use an axiomatic formula, then I'll explain. Lonely is charismatic man. It means men in society is lonely. A man who wants to deliver a message is lonely. Alone is numinous man. Man for himself. The inner world, the man is alone. Adam, before Eve was created, I'm referring to the previous lectures, roving along the uncharted lanes of a dreary world of animal, plant, and mineral, there was no other being who was alone. He wasn't lonely. Adam, in Eve's company, when he is unable to deliver the message of his experience to others, then he is lonely. In order to understand the difference between these two unique experiences, let us look at it from a different viewpoint, the pragmatic psychology. To be a lonely to be alone is identical with being the only one. The only. The Greek word of monos, one. The Hebrew yachid, yachid, not so much echad as yachid, would convey quite exactly the aloneness experience. It means not to be one, the only one. Loneliness is only possible among equals. Then am I among people? When I'm among people, I'm not alone. But I can be very miserably lonely. The peasant is not lonely among princes. But when he is excluded from his village community, then he becomes lonely. Nor would civilized man suffer from loneliness if he had to spend some time among Australian bushmen or South Sea Islanders. Only his expulsion from civilized society, in which he was born and reared, would hurt him deeply and evoke in him the feeling of loneliness. Aloneness means not finding anybody but me. To differ, alone means to be different. And to be the only one, and I don't mean the gentleman, ladies and gentlemen, in egocentric sense. I mean, please, I mean, of course, it can be infused with egocentrism, but I don't mean that. I mean metaphysical, in that metaphysical level. The only one, to be oneself, is alone. If a man is oneself, he's alone. In all the ramifications, aloneness is when man finds himself in all the ramifications of individuality, and otherness, and uniqueness. And this is exactly in which the inner worth of the personality is expressed according to Judaism. To be alone denotes the singular personal aspect, a new dimension which every personality has, a new dimension which is incommensurate with the unique dimension of the other personality, a new dimension which renders the existential experience incommensurate. You have existential experience, I have. You have an eye awareness, I have an eye awareness. I have a consciousness of my existence, the ego consciousness. Cannot compare them. Like a three-dimensional quantity with a two-dimensional quantity. They're not incommensurate. The numinous in a person, the mysterious in a person, the subject, which is not subject to charismatic externalization, and objectification. This spells aloneness. Adam for himself, or Adam for, or the I for myself is alone. Please don't interpret that in a natural meaning, in the meaning of egotism. Adam as a companion who, when he is eager to deliver his message to his other, to his fellow men, who is incapable of suppressing his life story, this is how a man begins to contribute to society. He cannot contain himself. He wants to pass on his message. Everybody has an interesting message for others, whether it's a scientific message, or it's an ethical message, or it's an economic message, or it's a political message. Everybody's contributions is a message. I mean, it's a kerygma. He's incapable of suppressing his life story and keeping it a secret. Then he becomes sometimes lonely. Sometimes, when life story is too powerful, it cannot be contained. It is too great an adventure not to be told. It's many times, I mean, man feels alone and he wants to approach the Tao, to whom he tries to deliver the kerygma, to relate his existential romance. Then, if he finds out that the Tao doesn't care for his message, then I suddenly step out of my seclusion. I'm somehow not satisfied with myself. And I want to approach the Tao, to establish contact liaison with the Tao. And I tell him, listen, I have a nice story to tell you. I mean, the story may be scientific invention or anything, a nice story. You'll be interested to hear this story. I mean, a great message. And the Tao turns around with scorn and disdain. Then Adam came to Eve, I don't know whether this transpired or not, apparently not, and said he wanted to deliver a message to her, probably a message of love. And Eve turned around haughtily, said, I'm not interested in your feelings. Then Adam was not alone at that time, because he was already in society. Then he felt alone. When society does not consider his message essential, in his contribution worthwhile, if his story is ridiculed, and his accomplishments rejected, then he feels he is not needed in society, then he's over. If Eve rejects Adam Friday morning, Adam was not lonely, because he had no need to communicate with anybody, because there was nobody. But Friday afternoon, after Eve sprang into existence, and he wanted to communicate with her, to flirt with her, and if Eve rejects Adam, the latter suffers from loneliness. It means, in other words, the solitary man, the man who is alone, can never be lonely. The lonely man is never alone. He is alone. Why is he not lonely? Because he's alone. Because there is no one else like him. Association, direct communal existence, communication of existence, does not fascinate him. He refuses to step out of himself to meet other fellow. His participation in communal life is indirect, and that's why he's not here. Now let us see. What do you suffer from? From aloneness or loneliness? I'm not speaking now about the Jew, about modern man. Loneliness and aloneness represent not only two disparate metaphysical ideas, it means numinous experience of Adam and the charismatic experience of Adam. Adam for himself and Adam in company with Eve. Of numeric kerygma, but constitute two different experiences, even at the psychological level. Loneliness is a destructive emotion. Very destructive. In Chacham Kibbalah Nisoy, no one is as wise as the man of experience. I can tell you. Loneliness is a destructive emotion. It fetters one's mind. Expresses itself in morbidities, in simple morbidity, unnerving anxiety, in mental dreariness, and self-negation, which borders almost on self-suicidal tendencies. Aloneness It is, if I may use the expression by Adler, it is a disjunctive emotion, loneliness. Basically, a destructive emotion. Aloneness, contrary to loneliness, is what Adler says. I mean, if I use this term, he doesn't speak about that, but the term is a conjunctive emotion. It's a creative experience. Although not always a pleasant one. You see, an experience can be a great experience, but not a pleasant experience. It sets all our aptitudes in motion, kindles the flames of rebellion against the trite and conventional, awakens in man his dormant talents and calls for action. If a man understands the feeling of aloneness, I'll speak about that. Feeling of aloneness can be transformed into egocentrism, which again is a disjunctive emotion, but there are limits on it. And Judaism was pretty aware of these fine boundary lines. Men, now let us come to men. Men is aware of both numinous and charismatic aspects. We said basically man can never be for himself completely, can never be in society completely. Correct? That's what we said before. He is numinous, he's rooted in himself, he can never rid himself of these roots. On the other hand, he's not satisfied with himself. He has to step out. Letove yota adam levado. I mean, it's not good for men to be alone. And levado means they are not lonely, but alone. Alone. Esale ezachne, they all create a helper opposite him. I mean, there is a dialectical experience. He oscillates, he fluctuates between two poles, between two extremes. He is for himself and then in society, both. So men... When I said the lonely man is never alone, the man who is alone is never lonely, I spoke about ideal types. But concrete man, practical man, is both. He can be alone, he also can experience loneliness. Man is aware of both the numinous and charismatic aspects. Within his personal existence, must experience aloneness as well as loneliness. He experiences aloneness as numinous, as mysterious person for himself. He experiences loneliness in his search toward society, toward another. He must feel alone because solitary Adam in him, in every of us, there is a solitary Adam before the creation of Eve, does not care, nor is he able to communicate anything to others. He is silent, withdrawn into himself, lives in solitude, in hiding. He does not meet anybody who resembles him. He is the unique and the only one person, strange and one-timely. He is alone without friends and without tying himself or integrating himself into a community existence, into togetherness and existential fellowship. As I said, Judaism considered all our ties, social ties, as relative, because even marriage, no sacrament, can be divorced. For one reason, because only charismatic men can tie himself with a woman. Adam, from Friday morning, before Eve was created, did not enter the marriage union. And this is why husbands survive the death of their most beloved wives, wives survive the death of their most beloved husbands, regardless of the impact of the first shock. Now, yes, on the other hand, we must experience loneliness. Companionable Adam, not solitary Adam, wedded to Eve, living in comradeship with others, anxious to deliver his message, to reveal his inmost self, to communicate something of his personal, intimate, existential awareness to, and live in communion with others, must at one time. And this experience everybody must go through this experience. Must at one time or another find the ridicule or misunderstanding. His message not wanted, and his story rejected, and the greatest and the lowest one. Even the great and mighty must reach the stage when they are not more needed, and hence looked upon with sympathetic disdain. The great scientist who has, for instance, revolutionized thinking, and whose contribution to society was of enormous value, will finally discover that they based on his very discoveries and ideas. Other men, younger and more vigorous intellectually, since they did not have to struggle with the old and the obsolete as he did, and for whom he has paved the way, have advanced much farther than he. He must realize that he, the teacher of a whole generation, must listen carefully now, a time comes, to the opinions of his disciples, and that his message is no more relevant. If there was a man who experienced it, I can tell you, who was the greatest scientist of our generation, Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein's creativity ran dry. You know, he's very well scientist now. And his own theories, by Fermi and his disciples and the young people, have worked with his own theories to such an extent that in his late years, he didn't die old, with which he could not cope intellectually. And he was, I mean, people who were close to him told me, he was the most miserable person on earth. Of course, people paid tribute to him, lip service, the layman, but the scientist is not interested in the tribute paid by the New York Times. It's not important. To him, it's important. I know, even in the halacha, in Jewish scholarship, we are not interested in the crowd, we are interested in a few scholars. And the few scholars upon whom Einstein was interested, they knew that he is lonely, he cannot contribute any lot to society. The same was true of Kant, the great German philosopher. Kant revolutionized German philosophy. His own disciple Fichte wrote that he himself, Kant, doesn't understand the consequences or the conclusions to be drawn from the philosophy he developed. And the philosophers of the time agreed with this Fichte, not with Kant. And this is true of the President of the United States when he leaves office. I believe that Eisenhower is beginning to have this feeling now. That's what I'm afraid. Not afraid, I wouldn't say afraid, but I understand this feeling. And this is everybody, a rabbi, when he gets old, at least older, not a rabbi shouldn't get too old in order to be not wanted by society. If he crosses the threshold of 40, I mean, he's already on the other side of the fence, and so forth. We cannot escape from this experience, however excruciating it is. Loneliness is the twin feeling of disillusionment. This is the twin feeling of disillusionment. And Judaism said, I'll come later to it, anybody and everybody must be disillusioned once in his life, must be defeated. A man cannot be victorious. And if he is victorious continuously, so at least he is defeated in death.
Of course, man. Can't win.
Huh?
Can't win.
Yeah, can't win. But Judaism said that a man must be defeated, and our ways and means how men can mitigate his defeat. I'll come later to this problem. Must be defeated, not in death, but in lifetime. In his lifetime. Loneliness is the twin feeling of disillusionment. And since one must encounter frustration and defeat, he is ipso facto condemned to the agony of being rejected by society. Isn't an old father rejected by his own children? Even if they are good children and they attend to his need. I mean, I know that from my own experience. And anybody, there is no one who is. And even if a beloved wife, beloved husband takes sick, and the doctor comes in and tells the wife that the disease is fatal. Of course, the shock at the beginning, as a rabbi I happen to know, you certainly know, all the same problem. The shock is terrific. Many shut off completely. The wife or the husband cannot imagine, cannot visualize a life without his beloved mate. I mean, how will he go on living? If he saw something, the thread of life is torn, interrupted. Yes, correct. But it takes a little time, yes, and then he begins to readjust himself to that. And the beloved wife, the moment, still when the wife or the husband is still sick, still in the house, she's looked upon, or he or she, looked upon as a dead person, not belonging to the circle of the family. And mentally, inwardly, this loving wife with a daughter husband, the loving husband with a daughter wife, begins to readjust her or his life. I wouldn't say he or she is thinking of marriage already, but I don't know. I'm never sure about the human mind. I'm never sure about the human mind. I mean, I don't trust the human mind too much.
And particularly again, Freud introduced the subconscious, what's going on there, no one knows. You see, and begin to readjust the furniture as a hostess, a very capable hostess, which decided to take out the chair in the room, so already mentally begins to readjust, rearrange the furniture in the room. I mean, I would recommend to you to read Leon Tolstoy, his famous novel. It's not a novel, it's usually a short story, more or less. The Death of Ivan Ilyich, it is translated to the English. The Death of Ivan Ilyich. And described there actually a sick person who was dying. George, with a family, with station society, and little by little, loving, everything was loving. So, yeah, a warm atmosphere. But little by little, I see how the family is beginning to reconcile itself with the fact of his death. You notice already the seamstress coming into the house. What does the seamstress do in his house? Her pale wife is already has placed an order for mourning veil and mourning garment. And if there is a picture of the loneliness of man, of a mighty man, in the Russian aristocratic society of old, in the last century, here it is in this Ivan Ilyich, lonely, who when he died, no one sympathized with him. I wanted to know, what is the name? No, just a moment. I wanted something else. What's his name? The English writer, Wolf, yes? Thomas, what's his, Luke Home? Is there is how a brother or a sister dies. I didn't see the play, but I read a book. The sister died, and how after the sister dies, I mean, they were mentally prepared for the death of the sister. How they get so excited that they get drunk, I believe, or they get intoxicated somehow. They become hysterical because they are relieved of death. At one point, at one time or another, the living person becomes a load on the others. And death is a relief. I mean, it's involved in Luke Home. It's a sweet angel. It's a brother. I don't remember. I read it about 10, 15 years ago. I didn't see it. It's the same. You say play, visit, what kind of play? It's a play. All right. It's
But a man who
against
the whole village
turns. It's a different story. Different story, this is social rebels, yes, loneliness, yes. But here is what Tolstoy wanted to bring out. I don't know whether Thomas Wolfe wanted to bring it out, but Tolstoy wanted to bring out the exact idea of defeat. Man is defeated. He's not only defeated in death, he's defeated before death.
Well, that's what Wolfe gets involved in all it was, loneliness that you speak of.
Yes, this type of loneliness, but basically loneliness is the excruciating feeling, and it borders on the neurotic borderline. But the question is how Judaism has tried to solve it. Well, I will continue.
Next week.
Next week, yes. Yeah. Next week.